The content here is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as medical advice. Please consult a healthcare professional with any medical questions and concerns.
If you are experiencing an emergency or need immediate help, call 911. In no way does listening, reading, emailing, or interacting on social media with our content establish a therapeutic relationship.
I just get so angry. It's hard to sit still.
I don't want to be this way.
My brain just feels all scrambled.
Welcome to Scrambled. This is episode 59, ADHD Treatments, and I'm Nikki Shields here with my co-host, Chad Douglas. And we have our favorite guest of the last couple of episodes, Dr. Tanya Royster, psychiatrist, here to talk with us about all the various ways you can treat ADHD.
Well, welcome back, Dr. Royster. And again, we thank you for your time and all of your knowledge in the past two episodes that we talked about what it is, how to treat it, how it's diagnosed. We didn't talk about how to treat it. That's what we're going to do now. So how to diagnose what it is, signs and symptoms. That's what I was trying to do. And then treatment. So what are some treatments for ADHD?
All right. So the treatment of ADHD is, I won't say controversial. What's controversial is that stimulant medication, which is considered the first line treatment for ADHD, and we'll break down categories in a second, has gotten a bad rap over the years. It's had all these different misconceptions and falsehoods, and research has kind of borne out that all the things we thought about stimulants are predominantly not true, but it's hard to get rid of, you know, ideas once they're out there. So, you know, you've heard, you know, Ritalin is going to stunt your growth. And it's like, no, it's not. There's been plenty of research to prove this not true. But every day, today is 2023, parents still come in my office and say, I heard that Ritalin stunts your growth. And I just kind of smile and go into my literature review. But the hardest part about ADHD treatment is that there's so many myths out there that it prevents parents from even seeking help sometime. So, of course, there's two main categories of treatment. One is a medication or psychotropic psychiatric medication avenue, and the other is psychosocial or therapeutic avenue therapies. There was a very, very big study back in the 90s and early 2000s that proved that very, very intensive therapeutic multimodal interventions could yield the same benefit as medication. However, this study was done in like Long Island, New York. It cost about $60,000 per kid. It was very almost residential, where they went to camp all day. They had master's level camp counselors. They had all of this very, very high skilled people coordinating with us. They had care coordinators who like worked with the school. Like, it was a very, very intensive study, and it got about the same as stimulants. And so,
wow,
we know that it is possible to treat ADHD without medicine. However, it's very, very hard, very, very labor intensive, very, very costly. If you think about the children in your life, in order to get the parents, the teachers, and all the other adult figures in their life to move on one accord and behave in the exact same way and implement the exact same responses and, you know, the same way of talking to the child and rewarding the child, like, is nearly impossible. But if you can do that, you can produce almost the same results as medication. And so that was actually one of the primary turning points where we were confidently able to say, stimulant medication is the first line choice for ADHD. And that was very, very hard for people to hear, because nobody wants to think about giving a child medicine.
Yeah.
Like, typically it's our last resort. And this is one of the few instances where it's our very first resort. So the stimulant medications can be effective up to 80-85% of the time for children, like within a matter of days. And like, again, this MTA study was like 16 weeks or 6 months follow up, and it wasn't still equal results. We often start by talking about medication first for ADHD, and we may add on simpler forms of therapy if the child has some comorbid anxiety or depression, some additional symptoms outside of the ADHD. But predominantly, we start with medication. And then medication falls into two classes. One is the stimulant class, and you know, in our really clever nomenclature in medicine, the other is the non-stimulant class.
Yeah,
brilliant,
clever.
So, you know, we're very, very descriptive in medicine. So in the stimulant class, there are two families and everybody's heard of them. The head of the family, one family is Ritalin, and the head of the other family is Adderall. Those are two separate compounds, distinct, different compounds, but they're both stimulants and they both behave very similarly. They both have similar side effects. The predominant side effects for children who are on stimulants are either decreased appetite or difficulty falling asleep if the medication is given too late in the day. And that happens in like 60% of the children. So it's significant. We don't have a lot of medicines that we have side effects that often, and we still say they're good medicines. But because the side effects are short-lived and the effects of the medicine are actually short-lived, we tolerate it because the results, you know, are so substantial. So we always talk about the risk benefit. And with the stimulants, the benefit is so much greater than the risk that it's worth it. Medication is the hallmark. So you start out with an Adderall or a Ritalin or one of its, you know, sisters, brothers, or cousins. If the child has side effects or for whatever reason cannot tolerate it, I had a family last week that both parents were addicts and they had been sober for a while. And they said, honestly, if we could use a non-stimulant, we would feel safer having that in our home. Right? They say, if that's the best for our child, we'll have a grandparent come over or something, but we don't want to place our family at risk. And that's an important thing about the stimulants. Stimulants can be abused, yeah. Right? Now, the interesting thing is, mostly people with ADHD do not abuse them because it is a therapeutic effect for them. I describe it as if let's just use an arbitrary number and say 100 is the amount of brain juice you're supposed to have. And a person with ADHD has 25. When they take the stimulant, it brings them up to 85 or 90 or 100. So they're not abusing it. They're just filling up the cup. It's when people who don't have ADHD, they're already starting at 100. So when they take the stimulant, they're going to 150, 175, and that's where the abuse comes in, that craving for that extra excitatory kind of experience. So there is a risk of abuse with stimulants, but it's much more likely to be from someone who is around the child than the child themselves. So whenever I have a teenager, I give them a whole speech about don't, you know, because teenagers brag about everything, right? Don't go brag. And I don't want you to be embarrassed that you have ADHD, but I don't want you to become a target. And I don't want your backpack to become a target. So if people think you might have your medicine in your locker or people think you might have your medicine in your backpack, somebody could try to steal your stuff, right? Because they have nefarious things, not because you are going to have a problem with it. So stimulants do have that, you know, risk to it. And so that's one of the things that people get concerned about. The other myth that people have is going to make my child a zombie, right? They're hyperactive, bouncy all over the place, and then they're just going to become still, like mm-hmm. just like a statue. And I'm like, no, that's not the goal. And that's not what we're going to do either. So you have the stimulants, which have those risks and benefits, and then you have the non-stimulants. So you might say, like, if we know that we have non-stimulants, why do we deal with all those risks and benefits? So the non-stimulants are effective, but they are not as effective for as many children, and they take longer to work, and they must be given on an everyday basis. Whereas because stimulants are shorter acting and immediate acting, you can decide, like, it's a Christmas break, we're not going to take the meds for this Christmas break, we'll just take them back when school starts, or we're not going to take them over summer or things like that. But the non-stimulants have to be given every day to keep the blood level of the medicines up to a certain level and to keep them effective. So for some families, that's really hard to remember to take a med every day, especially like in the summer or on holidays. When you stop a medication, there is about a 15% chance that it won't work the next time. So then you get on this kind of merry-go-round of trying a med, it works, you stop it, it doesn't work, trying the next med, it stop it, it doesn't work, et cetera.
I wanted to ask, before we talk about specifics, what you just said, that like if you take a med and then you stop it and then you try again, there's a 15% chance it won't work. Why is that? What happens?
And so what we believe, you know, and that everything we understand about medicine is about observation, because everything in the body is a closed system, right? And so we're really trying our best to observe what happens and make conclusions from that. So what we kind of believe happens is that the body kind of habituates to it, like almost immunity. We, you know, I guess that's not in the truest sense of immunity, but in the kind of common understanding. And so the body acclimates to it. And so when you reintroduce it, it doesn't have the same strength of effect. And so then we don't get the same strength of response.
That makes so much sense. Mm-hmm. Okay. Another question. I've just got all the questions for this.
Yeah.
So I've always heard that if you give a child a stimulant medication and it doesn't work, they don't have ADHD. Like if you don't get the, and so like as a therapist, of course, I've like challenged that thinking and done some research, but like, how can we help people understand that that's not necessarily the case? There's a lot more to it.
Yeah. Well, first thing, nothing works for everybody, right? I started out by saying 80 to 85% of the time it works, which means that 15 to 20% of the time.
Math is not a prerequisite for this podcast.
Yep, no, don't have to do it.
15 to 20% of the time, it doesn't work, just on general principle. Nothing to do with the kid, the diagnosis, or whatever. The other kind of way to dispel that myth is a stimulant is something that stimulates, right? So even a person who doesn't have ADHD, if they take a stimulant, will notice a spike in their attention, in their focus, in their concentration. That's why people take coffee and Coke and Coca-Cola.
To be specific.
But Coke as well. those are stimulants. And so people take them to heighten their senses and their awareness. And so it happens to everyone. If it doesn't happen to the desired treatment effect, that doesn't mean you don't have the diagnosis. That's why we have so many different medication options to try, because nothing works for everybody.
You mentioned the non-stimulants you have to take every day. Mm-hmm. What happens if you miss a dose? Can you make it up, or will you see some of those symptoms return?
Yes. So if you are already up to therapeutic level, depending on way that a medicine works. So here we go, breaking down my medical school in 15 seconds. medicine takes a while to build up in your system. The amount of time that takes is called a half-life to get to steady state. Right. Okay. And steady state is where the medicine has slowly built up over time, and now it's at an effective therapeutic level. So when you take the medicine every day, it stays at steady state and it stays effective. When you miss a dose, it drops. Okay. And so when you take the medicine again, it will slowly build back up to steady state. But depending on how much you've missed, depends on how far it's dropped, depends on when the symptoms will pump back up. Right. So it kind of all depends. The longer the half-life, the more time you have if you miss a dose. The shorter the half-life, the less time it will take before symptoms will pop back up.
But the stimulant, you could miss a dose and it's not going to be a huge difference.
Yes, because the stimulants are not building up in your system over time. You are getting an immediate reaction or response. I think I don't remember which episode, because we've had such good conversation, but we talked about the blood-brain barrier as being a fence around the brain. And so what the stimulants are doing is turning up the hose and spraying out more neurochemicals for that day, right? And at nighttime, when that medicine wears out of your system, the nozzle gets turned back down. And so you don't have the buildup to steady state like you do with the non-stimulants. You just have a temporary increase in production, and then it goes back to your regular baseline.
Which makes sense when you said don't take it too close to bedtime, because you're going to get that steady stream of hose spraying at your brain, and that's not easy to sleep to.
Well, and so let me say, there is one stimulant that has been formulated in a slow time release. And I think this was developed because parents had a really hard time with mornings, right? The medicine takes 30, 45 minutes to kick in. And so mornings were very, very challenging. So this one particular company has created a stimulant that is slow release. You take it at night, and it starts to be slowly released in your system. So it's in your body when you wake up in the morning. It's considered like a boutique drug. So a lot of insurance companies don't cover it. But the parents that I have on it, they love it. they love it.
I have a friend who wakes up her kids, and she's like, I wake them up and I have their little glass of water and their little morning meds just before their feet even hit the floor.
Yeah, I
get that.
I have some parents that do that. And then they're like, okay, take a little nap. You got 30 more minutes.
Dr. Royster, going back to the abuse of things, I tend to hear of like weight loss, and I'm curious to get, okay, so that some of those like Adderall, Ritalin can be used for weight loss, but that's not why they're prescribed. But now you have the, like the Ozempics and the diabetes drugs that people are using for that same thing. Mm-hmm. Thoughts?
Those are actually different types of appetite suppressants, and different, they're working in a variety of ways. And the appetite suppressant is a secondary side effect, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so that's how they have come into this kind of vernacular. They were designed specifically for diabetes control, and one of the side effects was reduced appetite and weight loss. And then people said, well, hey, if you can get reduced appetite and weight loss, I'll take it. Right? And so you now have the problem where there's a national shortage because people are buying at these boutique weight loss clinics and people who have diabetes can't get access to them. Because if I'm an insurance, I mean, if I'm a drug manufacturer, I would rather get full price at a boutique clinic than whatever the insurance company is going to broker with me, because that's what they do. They broker for prices for these drugs, for these medications. And at the boutiques, they're like, we'll pay your full price because we got, you know, fancy high paying clients. And so there is a shortage nationwide. In all of these medicines.
Oh, that's going to keep me awake tonight of just thinking like the amount of money and stuff. And then, I mean, you talk and you can sit here and say the same thing about some of these drugs sort of, but like the diabetes drugs, like that's a life and death thing.
Absolutely. I
mean, the folks who need that.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit more about some of the pushback you get from parents. If you diagnose a kiddo with ADHD and say, let's talk about possible medications, do people A, go, okay, great, or is it no, that my kid doesn't have ADHD, and then the medicine talk?
Yeah, all of that. So, you know, there's this initial, thank God there's something that I can hang my hat on. You know, I'm not just a bad parent. I just don't have a bad kid. Like there's something, oh great, there's treatment. Oh my God, no, my baby has to take pills. Like they go through this emotional roller coaster in about the course of 90 seconds. And the biggest thing is that all the myths that have been out there, everybody knows somebody who has a story about my brother took Ritalin or my brother took Adderall or the kid down the street from me was dealing Adderall. Like everybody has a story about Ritalin, whether it's true or not, whether it's their story or they just heard it three times from other people. But parents go through a wide range of emotions. And I try to coach them through that if they're not acknowledging it, because it is. I tell them, it's a very difficult decision to put a child on medication. I don't take it lightly as a doctor, and you shouldn't take it lightly as a parent. So let's make sure that we talk about all the fears, all the possibilities that we can, and then know that this is an open channel. And I always tell them, don't wait till the next appointment. Leave me a message. Call me. Like, don't feel like you're out there on your own and you just have me every 4 to 6 weeks or whatever.
Yeah. As we talked about in the last episode, technology, I mean, that's a great way to get in touch with any doctor. Now you can do the apps and everything and get a quick message. And most of them are good at getting back, or at least a staff member.
Yeah.
How long does it take a family to realize whether this is the medicine that's working? Is it pretty immediate or?
Yeah. So particularly if we're using one of the stimulants, I mean, they can tell within a course of a day or two.
Okay.
The most the reason it usually takes longer is, say the child is a little bit more muscular or a little bit older, then we may have to build up to a higher dose. I personally like to recommend that we start with a low dose and increase it every 2 or 3 days. They do have, you know, technology calculators where you can put in a child's metabolism and their weight, and it'll give you a expected dose. But I personally find that those doses tend to be a little bit too high. Okay. And so I would prefer, and I also think it gives the parents some comfort, to start at the very, very lowest dose and then incrementally go up. So in that case, you may see a little bit of response on the first day and then a little bit more response on the second day or the third dose as you increase it. But once you get to that dose, which is usually in the matter of a few days, maybe a week or more, depending on, you know, your child's size and weight, you're going to see results like in 30 minutes. Like it's, wow. It is literally miraculous. Like I just cracks me up when parents are just like, we know to get that medicine, in, you know, hers. But
I mentioned in the last episode, it literally was life changing. It was like a switch went off. And yeah, it made things for the better. So
yeah. And so that's with the stimulants. With the non-stimulants, like we said, with that half-life process and getting up to steady state, that can often take 4 to 6 weeks. And so, you know, I always tell parents, you know, that's hard. If you come to me when your kid is failing and at risk of being retained in a grade, 4 to 6 weeks is a long time, right? Mm-hmm. So that's another reason that the stimulants are our first line treatment. But there are plenty of reasons why we use the other ones as well. Now, this is another, I'm not trying to bash the insurance industry, but this is another place where interference in our clinical care, because many insurance companies have a step therapy policy, which means you have to fail lesser expensive treatments first before they will let you consider, even if it's in the clinical best interest based on the doctor and the parent's discussion, you have to fail other cheaper things first before they will let you try those things. And that is totally out of the doctor's control. And so that's an insurance industry issue that came along when managed care came along, you know, 20 years ago or whatever. And you know, I don't like it, but I share that with parents and say, hey, like, this is what I recommend. But if your insurance company doesn't pay for it, we may have to do these other things first. We already talked about the risk of those things and why we aren't choosing them. But this is insurance industry.
I like that you guys talk about insurance, and Nikki's done it too in past episodes, because I, as a parent, I don't think of that. Maybe I should more, but you guys in the medical profession, I like that you guys are bringing that to light to the parents who might not think like that and go, yeah, I forgot, check with your insurance, and there are obstacles.
Yeah. And I also have started giving the parents that as homework, because they, you know, they'll say, well, the pharmacy wouldn't fill it. It's not that the pharmacy wouldn't fill it. Your insurance company wouldn't pay for it. So I'm like, call your insurance company in advance, ask them these questions. I tell the parents, these are the 2 or 3 questions you need to ask them. And then when you come back with that homework, we'll be able to make a choice that, number one, will be covered, and number two, won't cost you an arm and a leg, because insurance companies also use these steps to charge different co-pays. So they may say, and their preference is based on their negotiating skills. If they made a better deal with Concerta than they did with Adderall, then they're going to prefer Concerta and expect you to use that on your child. And the problem I have, and I'm not going to get on my soapbox, but
I don't know. I kind of want you to, because I'm sitting there going like, oh my gosh.
The problem I have is they can change these negotiations every 3 months. They put out a new formulary. So if I have a child that's stable on Medidate, and then you change your formulary, and now the preferred agent is Concerta, you expect me and the parent to change the medicine just because you got a better price break over here? That's not fair. No. And so I have parents, I'm like, go advocate, talk to your insurance company. Like, this is not in the best interest of your child. And so, you know, there's a lot of challenges that we face with the insurance industry. And I've just started having parents call and be an informed participant in the process. And we get it done. It takes a little work on my part and the parent's part, but we get it done.
In the best interest of the child, of course.
In the best interest of the child.
You start on a medication as a kid. Are you on that medication for life?
No, not necessarily. So the course of ADHD is about a third of the kids As they approach adolescence, the hyperactivity will start to calm down. They will still have the impulse control problems. They will still have the attention and focus, and they may still have some of the frustration tolerance, but the hyperactivity will calm down. So depending on the child, the school, the resources, the coping strategies, there are many children that can reduce or stop medicine in adolescence. There is another third that by the time they reach adulthood, the symptoms, they figured out enough strategies that they don't do meds at all. But fully two-thirds of people who have ADHD will stay on some medicine for most of their life. They may go on and off depending on what they're doing in their life. But in order to function at their best level, they know that medication is one of the best supports for them.
But it sounds like a combination of medication and therapy is probably the best, or I guess it depends on the person.
Right.
It depends on the person. So therapy is really, really helpful when you are looking at like helping parents manage behavior, helping parents be consistent, helping the child understand their own triggers and how to manage their frustration. Like there are lots and lots of symptoms that we can target with therapy adjunctly with the medication. And so a therapist is a great tool to add to your ADHD treatment. If the child has anxiety or depression, it's almost a mandatory tool. Mm-hmm. Like we definitely need to add it if the child has any other psychiatric symptoms in addition to their ADHD. And I use it a lot, like I said, for parent and family functioning. You know, one of the things we talked a little bit about in the one of the previous episodes was how having a child with ADHD can affect the family and particularly the parent-child relationship. And so therapy can be helpful in mending, healing, and bonding that as a part of the treatment course as well. So the treatment of ADHD is what we call multimodal. That's one of our fancy, fancy words, but that means that more than one type of treatment is often important in the course of the ADHD treatment. And so medication is usually first line, but there's always room for, you know, therapy, family therapy, some organizational coaching. There's all different types of therapies that can be helpful depending on what the individual child or adult needs to support them on that journey.
Now, in my practice as a therapist, one of the biggest questions I get when it comes to ADHD is usually like, hey, we've gotten the diagnosis and we're just not ready to do the medicine thing. So we're here to see what kind of strategies we can get first. And so what would you say to those parents? And like, when is it time to consider medicine versus when is it okay to just say, let's wait and see?
Yeah, I always tell parents when it's causing the child impairment, right? So if the child has trouble turning in their assignments, like I had a little boy, I think it was today or yesterday, and almost all his grades were F's, but all of his homework was in his locker and under his bed, right?
You can relate.
So, so it's like, if you know, and it's like at a certain point, when a kid is 8, it's easy to pack up his backpack and the teacher will go in his backpack. But as they get older to middle school and high school, nobody's doing that. They have to be able to use, those are the executive functioning skills to get that stuff done, right? When it's causing impairment, so it could be academic impairment, like grades, learning. It could be social impairment. Nobody wants to be around you. Like you can't shut up, right? You keep interrupting people. You can't wait your turn. You have such poor boundaries. You're always bumping into people. Like when kids get around 9 or 10, they start to notice that stuff and they lose their patience. And so it begins to affect social relationships. They don't get invited to birthday parties. They don't get invited to sleepovers. That's a negative social developmental thing that, you know, that's detrimental, right? And then of course you talk about the familial relationships. Your parents can't take you to a restaurant. They can't take you shopping. They can't take you to the grocery store. The family doesn't want you to come to the barbecue. They're like, don't tell your family when there's a family reunion, right? Like, these are all negative social, you know, occupational, if they're an adult, you know, if they keep losing jobs or things like that. These are all negative impairments that happen because of the symptoms of ADHD. So when the symptoms of ADHD are causing problems in your life, that's when it's time to seek treatment. Like, you don't have to suffer. You don't have to have all these negative things affecting your life because of these symptoms. Yeah, can we try therapy first? Absolutely. It takes a very, very, very well-resourced, well-coordinated family. And when I say resources, I don't just mean money, like the amount of time and emotional energy it takes to do like that study that we talked about where everybody's using the same reward system, the same language, the same patience, the same tone of voice. And then you get the teacher to somehow do this as well. Like, the amount of emotional energy and reserve that it takes to try to treat a child with ADHD without medication is astronomical. And most families just don't have that reserve. You know, mom and dad are working. The teacher is certainly doesn't have it. And so it can be done, but it is astronomically challenging for the adults to be that coordinated and that sophisticated to pull it off for the child. And so, yes, can you try it? Can it help? Yes. And especially in the younger grades, you have lots of schools that will do check in, check out. The parents put the stuff in the folder. They put it in the bag. The teacher, as soon as the kid walks in the door, grabs the bag because they know if they let the kid put the bag down, something's going to get lost. Right? Yeah. All the adults are managing all of this. And that works until about third grade. And then fourth grade, we start to expect more independence. By fifth grade, we're expecting a lot more independence. And by sixth grade, we're expecting darn near independence, right? Mm-hmm. And so those techniques that work in, you know, kind of the K through three, they just start to fizzle out in the older elementary grades. Can you, you know, imagine you're in middle school and you expect seven teachers to do check in, check out?
No. Yeah. For multiple children too, you know?
Yeah.
Right. Well, it's just hard.
How effective can things like exercise be in treating ADHD?
So I would say that those are good complement to ADHD, but they're not a replacement for treatment. Like, sure, exercise is great for anybody for lots of reasons, but it also, you know, helps endorphins. It helps energy. Some people feel like they focus better, but you can't do exercise at a level consistently enough to make up for the deficits that ADHD causes. Like, you can't just get up in the middle of the class and do 30 jumping jacks and then
you could
sit
once
down.
And you might be asked to leave.
Yeah, you used to be able to. But then, you know, with today's children, like, if one kid does it, then everybody's going to want to do it, right? And the teacher's got to manage the classroom. So,
but it's the importance of recess too. And I know sometimes that's used as a punishment, is to take the recess away. And I know. I've seen it with my kid, and it's like, that's how he gets
stuff out. Parents always are oftentimes will schedule their child's appointment during recess. And then with telehealth, they're able to have their appointment with me. And I can always tell because I switch on the camera and the kid's in the car with a sad face.
Right, because they're missing recess.
Right. And I'm like, hey, what's going on? He's like, it's recess. How long is this going to take?
Yeah, you know? Right, exactly.
Oh, gosh. Are there specific types of therapy that you would recommend for a child with ADHD? You know, there's CBT, there's DBT, there's all these different like therapeutic approaches. Is there anything specific you recommend for these kids?
The most effective treatment for children with ADHD focuses on behavior management. So you're really helping the parent set up a structure that the child can be successful in. It has consistent rewards, consistent consequences, and it's a system and really the way that a family runs. And usually the therapist, that can be very short term, because really the therapist helps the family set it up. And then if the family kind of embraces it, then they can carry it on and just come for check-ins with the therapist once it's going. That's usually, like I said, an adjunct. And many teachers do these kind of things in their classroom automatically, right? Mm-hmm. The behavior management therapy is the most kind of common. And then, of course, maybe some supportive therapy or family therapy to really address the feelings or emotions that have come up as a result of the child's behavior prior to treatment.
We had an episode with an occupational therapist who talked a lot about sensory processing disorder. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we explored some of the overlaps between mental health diagnoses and sensory processing. What are your thoughts on sensory processing? Do you see that in the kids you treat?
100%. Yes. I had the great, great fortune in my very first job at the University of Illinois in Chicago to have the most fantastic team of occupational therapists on my team of treating adolescents with severe mental illness. And I have been a convert since my very first day of working there. Occupational therapy is one of the most amazing supports to children with all kinds of sensory issues and behavior and emotional dysregulation. The challenge is not all occupational therapists are adept, just like not all therapists are adept, and then not all psychiatrists are adept at everything. And so if you're in a community where the occupational therapists only do writing, you know, mm-hmm. and broken bones and rehabilitation, when you go in and ask them about that kind of sensory work, they may not remember it from grad school, right? Mm-hmm. But if you're fortunate enough to live in a community that embraces this sensory elements of work, oh, it can be so helpful to children and families. I'm a huge fan.
Agreed, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always just love to remind parents that treatment is effective. Treatment is safe. You are in partnership with your doctor. Your doctor knows medicine and you know your child. And so when you put those two things together, success is very, very likely. I like to say inevitable, but you know, it can't be perfect. So...
Well, Dr. Tanya Worser, we cannot thank you enough for the amount of knowledge that you've shared with us over these last three episodes. And I kind of feel like Scuba Steve. We did such a deep dive into ADHD, ready to come up for some air. So thank you so much. And I also want to give a plug to, you have a podcast and it's called From My Soul to Yours. And it's about just bettering yourself and being a better person. And so Nick and I are both fans of that. And you can check that out on Apple Podcasts as well, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yes. Apple or Spotify. Yep.
Well, we again appreciate your time and all of your knowledge. And we appreciate you, the listener, for sticking with us for three episodes, sharing this with those that you think could find the information beneficial. On our next episode, we have another guest and we're going to talk about how to have difficult conversations with your children. Mm. Our whole goal in starting this podcast was to start a conversation, and that conversation continues with you.